The Red Eye Radio Podcast is a service of Freightliner and Detroit.
Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED-EYE. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Hi, thanks for being here this morning. A couple of other stories out there since we are talking about the investigations of, what happened with all this Russian collusion? Republican lawmakers, this from the Daily Caller, have renewed their focus on Bruce Orr, the high-level Department of Justice official who was in contact with the author of the Steele dossier and whose wife worked for the opposition research firm that commissioned the document. California Republican Devin Nunes, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said Monday that Orr is going to become more and more important to his panel's investigation into the FBI and Justice Department's use of the Steele dossier to obtain a secret warrant to spy on the former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. I think people should pay close attention to it. Nunes said in an interview on Fox News yesterday, Ohio Republican Representative Jim Jordan, a member of the House Committee on the Judiciary, echoed Nunes' statements in a separate interview. He said Bruce Orr is key to this now. He said in an interview alongside The Hill's John Solomon. Solomon reported from The Hill on emails that the Department of Justice recently provided to congressional committees that he says show that Orr had a close relationship with the dossier author Christopher Steele and Glenn Simpson, the founder of Fusion GPS, the opposition research firm that hired Christopher Steele, the former British spy, to investigate the Trump campaign's possible links to Russia. When you read these emails, it's Glenn, it's Bruce, it's Nellie, it's Chris. It's like these were all best buddies, Jordan said. They were like friends. They were all working together on this project of putting this dossier together that has been disproven. And that's a quote. A congressional source who has been briefed on the Orr emails told the Daily Caller Foundation that the documents contained some gems showing a more direct connection between Bruce Orr, Christopher Steele, and Fusion GPS. Orr held two high-level positions at the Justice Department until he was demoted last December. He served as the director of the Department of Justice's Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, as well as Associate Deputy Attorney General, a role that put him just under Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates. Orr's wife, a Russian expert named Nellie Orr, worked for Fusion GPS on the Trump project. Simpson, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, told the House Intelligence Committee during a November 14th deposition that he met with Orr shortly after the 2016 election at the suggestion of Steele, and that Steele had met Orr before and after the election. Simpson did not tell House investigators that Nellie Orr worked for Fusion GPS. The FBI made the Orr and Steele were in contact with the FBI. Were in contact even after the FBI decided to cut ties with the former British spy because of his interactions with the media. The FBI made the decision on November 1st, 2016, after the Bureau discovered that Steele shared information with Mother Jones reporter David Korn. Steele's FBI handlers had instructed him not to obtain information on behalf of the FBI. So, you know, when you look at all of this, and again, we don't know specifically how this, you know, all worked, but what we're getting from the Republicans here is that Bruce Orr, who worked for the Department of Justice and whose wife worked for Fusion GPS, you know, you're talking about, as they said there, you're talking about a very close-knit group of people, even related by marriage, that the Department of Justice official and his wife involved in creating and putting together the Steele dossier that was used against Trump.
Yeah.
Wow. And again, it shows what I think the Republicans are trying to show is that there was like a, and I don't know what other term to use, there was a club of people that all had the same goal in mind. And there are people that should have been separated from it. The Department of Justice, Bruce Orr, his wife working for Fusion GPS, who's working on the Steele dossier, which was used by the FBI and the Department of Justice to obtain a warrant on, a secret warrant on Donald Trump using salacious, unverified information. Jim Jordan saying disproven. Right. Others saying unverified. But there's a close. I mean, there isn't a separation between the people putting together the propaganda and the law enforcement officials that are getting the warrant based on the propaganda, because your wife is putting together the propaganda.
You've closed a you basically have closed the loop. You've created a very direct link there in its motivation and purpose. From the collection of this unverified or disproven data to using it for the purpose of obtaining a FISA warrant. That's basically what you have here. You have now you're putting the dots together, the connections, and these would be very clear connections in that line of events, in that entire string of events.
That's really interesting what's going on there. So I wanted to bring that to everybody's attention. The other thing, to our last caller because we've been saying this for a long time, but just focusing in on it the last couple of days, especially after the protest in front of the White House that's been going on for over 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, the Russian annex part of it, mm-hmm. the signs that, Trump, treason with the Russians and everything else. And so we started last night on the narrative again, because we think it's a very important narrative for everybody on the left, all Democrats out there, to join us in wanting to release as much information as possible so we can find out the truth. So if Trump did collude with the Russians to hack or change the outcome of the election, that you can get him on it. And if he was not involved in any of it, then we can find the truth out there. The last caller bringing up, and I would just want to focus on this again because it's extremely important. He said, well, what the left will say is, you can't interfere with the Mueller investigation. Well, the Mueller investigation can't interfere with the House Intelligence Committee investigation.
Right.
No investigation constitutionally is viewed as greater than any other investigation.
Right.
The body that has oversight. In fact, you could make the argument, be an interesting debate, you can make the argument that actually the House Intelligence Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, they actually have, I think you can make the argument, more, that their investigation is more important because they actually have direct oversight.
Because they represent the people.
Because they represent the people. Mueller represents.
I think you could make that case.
Mueller represents the executive branch.
Right.
And so I believe you can make a good case by stating that
they have greater standing, basically.
The Mueller investigation is interfering with the House and the Senate investigations. And so that argument fell flat. That's why no Democrat uses it with us, because it's an easily defeatable argument. And the fact is, the Mueller investigation does not supersede any of the investigations over the oversight committees, and the oversight committees are the representatives of we the people that have oversight over these departments to find out what in the heck they're doing.
Yeah.
And so, no, that argument doesn't hold any water.
Well, and I think here, you look at a couple of things that are going on, the Manafort trial, and it seems like Judge Ellis is kind of an extraordinary type of judge. But if you listen to what he's doing and the challenges, the issues that he's having with the prosecution, he's paring that down to, all right, let's stick to the crimes that Manafort is charged with, essentially, and leave the politics of this all at the door, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what the case, any case, would have to be. It would have to be about those crimes that Manafort is charged with. Nothing else. Because the Mueller team really only has one path here. They only have one approach, one game. And that is to make sure that the jurors believe this is all about Russian influence in the election. Because ultimately, if they can't get Manafort to flip on the president, and we still ask the question, what do you mean flip? Flip for what? What crime? And as Ellis pointed out in the pretrial hearing, then this is all about, because he believed it, this is all about trying to get Manafort to work against Trump. That's what you're trying to do. They got Gates to work against Manafort. They're trying to get Manafort to work against Trump. You couldn't do that, so what are you doing? And the holes are everywhere in this entire scenario. Everywhere. So you look at what Mueller has right now. Has anything been leaked to the media about an actual criminal event, a crime that happened in relation to someone on the Trump team and the elections of 2016?
No, nothing.
Nothing has even been leaked. Can you imagine? Because that would be the story.
Well, but we do know, again, and I still think, you know, you had Rand Paul talk about it, but still the Republicans should be screaming this all the time. The only collusion that you do have, that everybody agrees with the facts of it, is that it was the Hillary campaign and the DNC
yes.
that colluded with the Russians, that communicated with the Russians through Perkins Coie, through Fusion GPS to Christopher Steele, who got the information from... that got the information from the Russians, which then Fusion GPS put it together. Bruce Orr's wife helped. He was in the Department of Justice at the time and a deputy attorney general. And the fact is, what the Democrat or Republicans are now claiming is that everybody was tied in order to, this is what it seems
to
they're going, to bring all this together to justify the dossier as a legit document to present to the court. But it was collusion all the way, you know, between the Department of Justice and Fusion GPS because of the relationship between Bruce Orr, who's married to Nellie Orr, who was part of Fusion GPS, who helped put the dossier together.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at what really stinks out there, where there's much more evidence, it's all in the Democrats, and it's a non-story.
No one's talking about it.
No.
I mean, you have National Review. You have Wall Street Journal. And those aren't, you know, I mean, especially with Wall Street Journal.
You got the Hill broke some of the info on Bruce Orr the other day in the emails going back and forth. So,
but and we know that things like this take time, but the mainstream media is not on this. I mean, you don't have the New York Times doing all of this work saying, okay, what is it that they're claiming, or what is it that would be potentially that would be a massive wrongdoing here if those who are pointing these things out, which would be, you know, the talk show hosts on radio, the National Review, Wall Street Journal, all of them that are pointing in this direction. Let's look at that. Let's fact check this and see. I mean, you talk about a Washington Post and a New York Times. If you're not on this part of this story right now, then there's really no hope for true journalism in those types of publication. I just believe that fully.
Get Sarah Jung on this.
Yes, exactly. Have her investigate all the white males who are involved.
Yes. I know she's a tech writer or whatever, but mm-hmm. Hey, whatever.
Well, again,
if she's a tech writer,
can you imagine?
If she's a tech writer, have her do the Farrakhan story.
If it turns out to be that they knowingly used false information to petition for a FISA warrant to monitor people inside the campaign, and it was all about the politics of it, about monitoring Trump and trying to bring, and then ultimately trying to delegitimize his presidency. Yeah, Watergate what?
866-90-RED-EYE.
Is your rig prepared for hot summer months? As the temperature rises, so does the importance of tire maintenance. Tire replacement is the number one roadside repair request during the summer months. Always make sure your tires are properly inflated and that your tires' tread depths match. Mismatched tire treads brushing against the extreme heat of the highway surfaces can result in more wear and tear, which is the last thing you need during a hot summer. You can help avoid tire breakdowns by conducting pre-trip inspections. Check to make sure your tread depths meet or exceed the DOT standards. And visually inspect your tires to make sure there are no nails, screws, or other road hazards that may increase your chances of a blowout.
This maintenance tip is a service of TA Truck Service Road Squad. If you break down, we show up. Call 800-924-SHOP.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Hurley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Coming up on the bottom of the hour, just a little bit on the Manafort trial yesterday. And it seemed like the prosecutors were going after his former partner, Rick Gates, and trying to destroy his credibility. You know, basically saying, look, you told stuff to Mueller that wasn't true.
Right. You know, admittedly.
Admittedly, you admitted that it wasn't true. And what they're trying to tell the jury is, you know, he's trying to say that he did these things along with Manafort, and
right.
what Manafort's lawyers are trying to do is destroy his credibility and say, no, you did these things, and here are things that we know you did without the knowledge of Manafort. Therefore, you have no credibility in a witness claiming that he did this because you've lied about so much. Secret Life even brought up his affair
from
A decade ago, but it's going in the direction of attempting to destroy his credibility completely.
Right, right.
And
if you add to that the idea of last Wednesday, wow, that'd be a week ago today, the prosecution actually floated the idea that they might not call Gates. And then the next morning, the judge saying, well, wait a minute, what do you mean? You're not going to call Gates? He's your key witness. You can't have conspiracy without calling him to testify. And I thought to myself, was that idea, was that moment on last Wednesday about the credibility of that their star witness, Gates, they knew that it was going to be picked apart.
Now, the problem for Manafort is the fact that this guy interned him and worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
If it was the other way around, I mean, still, if it was the other way around, it would be easier to defend.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, the jury may look at it and say, okay, he did this on his own, and no, he's not credible here, but there's no way he did this.
Right, he wouldn't have the ability to do this.
He wouldn't have the ability or the authority to do this,
right.
and that's what it gets down to. But what specific financial crime that would be, I don't know at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. There's still a question as to whether the defense wants to put Manafort on the stand. You know, that's always a real risk. But what you're trying to do in this case is discount the star witness, or explain away transactions. As, I don't know, didn't have any knowledge. You can do that without Manafort sitting in that seat.
Well, if you get the direct question, did you direct him to do it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the cross-examination by prosecution would be brutal. His credibility would then be on the line, of course, as it already is, but it would be even worse in front of the jury.
anytime, 24 hours a day. Say, Alexa, play Red Eye Radio, and we thank you.
And he is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. So I'm just reading this here. It was an op-ed piece in CNN.
All right.
Maya McGinnis, the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, talking about the debt, and the headline is, will the debt issue become a more pressing issue? And it's interesting because in the op-ed piece, and this actually had come out on July 31st, but it said Larry Kudlow, we don't believe the U.S. debt projections.
Okay.
All right. Of course we don't.
No.
But says, as a result, is an unprecedented debt binge by Congress over the past year, the national debt is about to roar back to life as a pressing issue after years of hibernation. This is from the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. In 2010, it was among the nation's top concerns. President Obama created a bipartisan National Fiscal Commission to come up with a plan to address it, but nothing happened.
Well, what makes them think it's coming back as a concern, as a hot political concern?
Well, I think she's making some of the points that we did. The amount of, because this is really affected, and we had talked about Jamie Dimon yesterday talking about the 10-year Treasury bill at 5%.
Right.
That'll wake up people. Because we have talked about, she says it here, she said, several weeks ago, the Congressional Budget Office laid bare its annual long-term outlook, the dire picture, and the next 15 years won't be pretty. Here's how it'll play out if nothing is done. By 2022, the Highway Trust Fund runs out of full funding. 2026, Medicare Hospital Insurance Trust Fund follows. 2032, Social Security Trust Fund surpluses dry up. And all beneficiaries, regardless of age or income level, will face a 21% across-the-board benefit cut. Before 2030, because this is the thing that you and I have talked about, we increased, you know, since the Obama administration, which is roughly $10 trillion in debt, we're over $21 trillion now. But since the Obama administration, we have had minuscule interest rates. So it was easy to keep borrowing money. Now interest rates are going up. You have 5% on the 10-year. You have, and you know, I was looking at the 6-month or the 3-month yesterday, which went from, because I used to buy 6-month Treasury bills, and I think the 3-month is up to almost 2.1%.
Mm-hmm.
That's quadrupled in the last few years, which means you have to do it. We talked last week about the extra tens of billions that we had to borrow in the last quarter and coming up in this quarter that we didn't have to borrow last year because of spending, but one of the biggest culprits is because of the interest now on the debt. And as she says here, by 2030, we will have $1 trillion annual interest payments. Just on interest will be in the trillions.
Yeah.
Is the projection. Interest rates have been low until now, but that's now changing. As rates go up, we'll have to pay more on new debt and all accumulated debt. The amount of interest, the amount that we pay in interest on the debt is set to triple over the next 10 years, something you and I have been on for the longest time.
Yeah.
But if interest rates rise just 1 point higher than expected, the government will owe an extra $2 trillion in interest over 10 years.
Well, I guess for me, it's because it's mind-boggling that relatively few people are concerned about just the principal amount of the national debt. It, I, my logic just goes straight to, who's going to care even as interest rates are skyrocketing? They're not going to care until someone takes something away from them.
Away from them.
And by that time, right. It's going to be a catastrophe. Right.
As she writes, that higher debt pushes up interest rates, too. The higher government debt puts up interest rates,
yeah.
Which translates into higher payments on mortgages, car loans, credit card debt, because debt is rising rather than stable. In 30 years, a family with a $300,000 mortgage can expect to pay approximately $45,000 more over the course of the mortgage.
Yeah.
And in 30 years, what will a $300,000...
Oh, my gosh.
In 30 years, the $300,000 will buy what?
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
That'll be buying a $130,000 house today.
Even in Texas, in our area, where it's relatively cheap compared to California, I have no idea what $300,000 is going to get you in 10 years, but it's not going to be big.
Interest also means less money for the rest of the federal budget. By 2023... will spend more on interest payments than Medicaid or defense, which means at that point, by 2023, we're talking about $700, $800 billion in interest alone.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be paid.
It has to be paid.
All priorities of all politicians will fall victim. The federal assistance that states rely on will be increasingly uncertain, and social safety net programs will be under pressure. When the debt doomsday actually arrives is anyone's guess. We are entering uncharted waters, the highest the national debt has ever been as a share of the economy is 106%. Immediately after World War II, we are on track to surpass that in 16 years, and debt will overtake the size of the entire economy as soon as 2027.
It won't change politically. It's not going to change until you take something or a lot of somethings away from people. Mm-hmm. And that's going to have to happen. I mean, there won't be a choice. It's not going to really be a decision. It's going to be a must because programs will just end.
At the turn of the 21st century, we were on track to actually pay off the debt. Then 9/11. Mm-hmm. The wars, new spending programs, Great Recession, natural disasters. During a strong economy, we should be preparing for the future events such as those, not pushing the credit card to the limit. But that's not the problem now.
No.
The problem is not that now. The problem is spending, and everybody wants everything. And what are the Democrats talking about? Think about this.
Giving them more.
They're talking about a $32 trillion program of Medicare for all.
Right.
They're talking about free college tuition for everybody, guaranteed jobs, a guaranteed income.
Yeah, basic living wage or basic living income.
Basic living income. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is where we live in a complete delusional fantasy world.
It might as well be monopoly money, frankly.
The Democrats are running on that. And the Republicans, as we have said, spending is not a concern.
Right.
And so when she asked the question that is it going to become a pressing issue, I believe, as you do, no, not until they start actually having to take something away from people.
Which is tragic because by then it will not
be too late.
It's going to be way too late. It is going to be a massive drag on the economy.
And that's why we've been criticized for it, and so be it. Really don't care. But what happened was we had a Republican Party that at least was concerned with the debt. They were concerned with the morality of putting what we want today on future generations. Now it's not an issue.
No.
They've dropped it.
We have decided that fiscal policy is not worth a second look anymore, even.
And the worst part of Republicans is, yes, Democrats are completely delusional by thinking we can continue on this spending pattern and add free college, add Medicare for all, add free basic income to people, cover everything for everybody 24/7. But they also believe in an intrusive government. And so you can have a government promise both, and what you end up with is an intrusive government. As we have said, Republicans have become just as delusional, many of them, by believing you can have a government that takes care of everything and spends like crazy, but won't be intrusive into your life eventually.
Right.
Sorry, doesn't work that way.
That's
also a delusional mindset.
That's as big of a delusion as any fantasy that's out there.
We want a big government. We just don't want an intrusive government. Sorry, doesn't. And the perfect example was Obamacare.
Mm-hmm. And here we are.
Give us the benefits.
Right.
Take away the taxes and the mandates on it.
Right. Stay out of my life. Oh, give me that.
And so since you have neither party that's concerned about it, and you don't even have a minor, you would think that we would have the minor fiscal party. That doesn't exist.
No.
I don't see a solution to the problem, even though we have had plenty of warning. It's just we as a nation have chosen to stick our head in the sand and say, just give me what I need today and somebody else will worry about it down the line.
Remember when then President Obama said the debt isn't a problem. And I said that's the equivalent of saying your kitchen is on fire, but you're in the bedroom, so it's not a problem. Well, now you have Republicans basically acting in the same way. And, oh, it's not a problem. And you can point to it. Right now, there is nothing politically that is going to ring true with Americans because they just don't. There's just no concern for it. They don't see it. You can't make them see it. Because what it will be seen as, what it will be spun as, is political rhetoric. The numbers don't lie. There's no way to get away from it.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Carley and I'm Gary McNamara. So there it is, Wall Street Journal. Elon Musk tweets he's considering taking Tesla private.
Okay. Good luck with that.
The stock went up.
Yeah. That's going to get a bump when you think there's going to be a buyout. The investors, the stockholders would have to, shareholders would have to vote on that. Then there's the bigger part of that. He's going to have to come up with
$70 billion.
$70 billion at least, depending on what the stock price is.
Yeah, Wall Street Journal headline.
It's over $400 a share now.
Where is he going to get the $70 billion to invest in Tesla? Who's going to do that?
Right. Where's that money coming from?
All right. So, we had talked football and everything, the whole kneeling and everything else, but concussions has been big. We've talked about football in general. Mm-hmm. This is just fascinating. I was telling you this in our pre-show meeting. This is a research that was led by the University of Buffalo. Mm. Okay? University of Buffalo. They actually looked at 21 different professional athletes from the area. They were Bills and Sabre players, hockey players and football players.
Okay.
And they talk about that CTE, the degenerative brain disease, mm-hmm. That's found in athletes. And it starts out, the study has shown it could be much more rare than originally thought. Hmm. That's the result of that University of Buffalo study that examined former Bills and Sabres players. Research on the damaging effects of CTE and its connection to concussions has sparked debate. But the team at UB who led the study says evidence shows there is no reason to pull your kid out of football practice. It was a question of if, but when. For one former Buffalo Bills wide receiver, Luke Pacone, he had suffered concussions in his football days and thought CTE was inevitable. Barry Willer led the research team for this study. He said, when we started this study, we truly believed we would see a much higher rate of cognitive decline and dementia, and we simply didn't find it. Dr. John Letty, who co-led the study, says the team was surprised at their findings. The information coming out about CTE suggests that many players would suffer from chronic brain damage as a result of playing contact sports. But after examining 21 professional football and hockey players who are alive today. The UB team published papers on CTE, concussions, and early onset dementia. We basically found that there was no evidence of early dementia in retired contact athletes. The team says there's a lot more to know, the research team on CTE, but they were very, very surprised in this initial study that they didn't find it. I wonder how that's going to be peer-reviewed and how that will be looked at by other studies. You've seen some of the studies on, you know, when they talk about those the players that they've done autopsies on who have died mm-hmm. and said that they have found, you know, CTE there. Mm. Well, was CTE the cause of what people might have perceived was a mental, you know, a brain situation or mental situation with them? Has that been proven that that was actually football that caused it or hockey that caused it? And that's some of the questions that this research team is asking.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED-EYE. I'm Gary McNamara along with Eric Harley. In the news this morning,
I'd like to thank President Trump. Mr. President, coming to town, I'd also like to take the time to enter to thank Vice President Pence for coming in next week. And the big shoes that I'll be filling. I wouldn't have got through a lot without him through this process. Congressman Pat Tiberi.
And that's some audio from Troy Balderson at his victory speech last night. This is in the special election in the 12th Ohio Congressional District in a race where he claimed victory, even though he has not been yet announced as the victor. He's up by around 1,700 points, but there are still 8,400. After 100% of the precincts and early votes have been counted, he's up by 1,700 votes. There's still 8,400, approximately 8,400 absentee votes that have to be counted. And like I said, he's up by roughly, he's up by 1,754, and there are 8,483 outstanding absentee and provisional ballots left to count.
That district, the population as of 2016 was roughly 750,000, and if you add that those absentee ballots, we're looking at a total turnout of over 210,000, which is a healthy turnout for that special election.
In the Republican primary in Kansas, and the reason these are viewed as important politically is because of the Trump endorsement. The Trump-backed Secretary of State Chris Kobach and incumbent Governor Collier were waiting still for the results. I mean, that's still neck and neck. Last I saw, there was, I think, 93%.
Yeah, RCP is reporting 95%.
95, okay. 95, yeah. Knowing.
And it really is a tight race.
What's
you're looking at about 460
votes.
Vote difference between the two. With Collier right now in the lead by 459 votes. Wow.
Kobach, you mean leading?
This has with 90, according to RCP. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes,
yeah,
I'm sorry. Yes, you have Kobach leading with just a few hundred, and it just changed.
About 600.
They just jumped. It's about 600 votes right now. Yes.
Right, about looks like 530, something like that. But 40.7 to 40.5 mm-hmm. percent of the vote so far for candidates in that. The other two candidates with 8.8% and 8. So there's where we are right now on, you know, on the ones that were viewed as important and a possible barometer.
Right.
And I we're in August.
Well,
the whole landscape can change.
There's going to be obviously greater focus on some of these races as that focus starts to change and the candidates are in place. Interesting looking at the Kansas governor GOP primary and a very healthy turnout. And then you look at the Kansas governor Democratic primary, nowhere near.
No.
Between all three of the candidates there. So that's pretty much a given. It's somewhat opposite in Michigan. You and I were discussing this during the break, where the turnout there for the governor Democratic primary was healthier by last count I had well over 100,000 as opposed to the Michigan governor GOP primary. But again, that doesn't mean anything necessarily. That kind of, distance between the two, we'll see what happens and who gains momentum going into the election, the actual general election between those two. So I'm guessing on Ohio 12, we probably won't hear until sometime later today. I don't know how long it will take to be guessing.
I mean, I can see that there would be a count throughout the day where the election would say, okay, we've counted 1,000. Here's what it is right now.
And right.
But, you know, you have 8,400 ballots. How long does it take? I don't know.
Yeah, not sure.
That's something that should be able, you would think would be able to be done in 24 hours. But we will we'll see.
Yeah.
I do want to have another audio cut here because the Iran sanctions, president announcing them here this week. John Bolton had a chance to talk on PBS last night and get into a discussion on the Iran sanctions. Here's part of that interview.
Ambassador, thank you very much. What is the goal of the sanctions that are snapping back today?
Well, we believe that the government of Iran has not given up its intention to get deliverable nuclear weapons. And so by abrogating the Iran nuclear deal, which we felt was fundamentally flawed, this enables us to put sanctions back on and to recreate the pressure that we think will be necessary to get the regime to change its behavior. We've been in consultation with our allies about this. We're all of a mind. We don't want Iran to get nuclear weapons. But I think we all also recognize that the Iran deal didn't cover ballistic missile development. It didn't cover Iran's terrorist activity. It didn't cover Iran's belligerent military activity in the Middle East. We think all those issues need to be on the table to talk to Iran about.
Some of those activities that you mentioned across the Middle East are fundamental to Iran's regime and fundamental to Iranian behavior. Are you actually trying to change the Iranian regime itself?
No, that's not the administration policy. But, you know, when you say support for terrorism is fundamental to the Iranian regime, it puts us on a course that's flatly contradictory to basic American national interest. Iran has been the central banker for international terrorism for a long time. That's not behavior that we should tolerate. And when you consider the danger of a terrorist regime in possession of nuclear weapons, I think you can understand why our concern with the badly flawed Iran nuclear deal led the president to withdraw the United States and to take the steps we've taken, which we think have already had a significant detrimental impact on Iran.
Bolton needs to be out more.
Yeah,
I think so. Because what, and we have said, the communications in this administration, for the most part, stinks.
Yeah.
Bolton is not one of those who stinks at all. He is extremely focused and extremely clear on what the administration wishes to do. Now, I want to play this little bit, another part of the audio cut and a follow-up question here, because it just shows you, Bolton goes through this every time he's asked a question, or every time he asks a question and answers it. He's always asked a question like this, basically, well, you've thought this before. You've written about this before. You've said this before. And that's not what you're doing now. And then he explains to them, this isn't my administration. I simply give advice. if this happens again.
Well, with all due respect, sir, a lot of people listen to what you've said and what you've written over the years. Your support for the group MEK, a group that advocates for regime change, and also the administration's policies right now in general, advocating for protests that are calling for political change, as well as putting economic pressure on the regime. Is that not a policy to actually change the regime itself?
Here we go.
No, it's not, and I'm always happy to have reporters and anchors refer to my previous writings. I'm glad you had a chance to read them, but that's not what I do now. I give advice to the president. I don't make decisions. I think I can say...
let's be clear about what his role is.
Yeah, I'm not president.
Right.
I simply give advice.
Because that was an opinion. I mean, his writings and,
right.
and we've had Bolton on before. And at that time, that's when he was issuing opinion. He was, this is something that they do in between jobs often, or when they retire, they issue their opinion based on their experience. And he has a great deal of it. It's interesting that Rouhani has been essentially targeted in a number of these protests there in Iran. Death to the dictator. Death to Rouhani. This is what people in these protests in Iran are screaming. And by the way, those protests were going on before officially the U.S. announced those sanctions. It was a given that they were going to happen. Most had expected it. But when you have that situation in Iran, forget about Bolton. It's the people and the protesters, we should say, that are calling for a change in the regime.
I'm so glad you brought up that point, because I think of my young friend, and she's still young. I believe she's still in her 20s. But
she's younger than you.
Yeah, she's younger than me, so she
she's
is young.
Still younger than you.
Yeah, she'll always be younger than me. But she came over from Iran because she had relatives over here
right.
at 18. She had a small window when she was allowed to come over. And I remember asking her, and at this point she'd been here maybe 3 years. She was 21, I think, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she became a U.S. citizen,
right.
Which was always her goal, to become a U.S. citizen. She wants to be an American. And I remember asking her the question, because once I had the opportunity, when somebody pointed out to her, because she was a server in a restaurant that I used to go to, and I used to golf with the owner all the time. And so they said, yeah, she's from Iran. And I went, oh, I got a million questions for her. And caught her one day and started asking her questions. And so I believe she was 21 at the time. And I said, she kept telling me, oh, so what do you think about America? Do you like it? She goes, and what about the people over there? She goes, we all love America. I said, you don't blame us for anything? She goes, no. And I said, well, how do you know if your news is censored? She goes, we have the internet. We know what's going on.
Yeah.
And I said, well, then what do you view as the problem? And this is a quote from her. She said, the problem with Iran, our stupid government and our stupid religion.
Mm-hmm.
That's a quote. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that from her. And there was a lot of anger in her. And I asked her, I was trying to, and she was telling me about, the bathing, the swimming pools. You couldn't swim with boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I started, and I realized that a lot of the things that she objected to is a lot of the things that somebody who left an oppressive country at 18 years of age, from their point of view, would be furious at. We
right.
can't listen to the music that we want to listen to.
Right.
We can't associate with boys the way we want to. We can't dance. We can't do this. It was all the things that build rebellion in a young person
mm-hmm.
if you live in an oppressive society, but you feel free to speak about it.
Yeah.
But the one thing that she told me was, we all know what's going on. We all know what's going on. And I saw another documentary when I was on vacation back in New York, and my father and I were watching it. It was a guy, I can't remember whether it was PBS or whatever, but this guy went over and just toured all through Iran. And everywhere he went, people love the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they all said, well, it's the governments. It's the governments, not the people. It's the government. You could tell they were free to talk, but they were so incredibly friendly and positive about the United States. And that's one thing that I don't think that we know over here. We assume that because the leadership of the country hates us, that the people aren't getting news. It's not the same as in the Cold War. The internet didn't exist during the Cold War. It probably isn't the same with North Korea, since right. the ability to have the internet isn't over there, and they have much more control of the propaganda over the people. These countries don't have that same propaganda anymore. And it's just important, I think, that the people of the United States know that. So I'm glad you brought it
well,
up.
Because these recent... Yeah, right, I mean...
And, they're not protesting Trump.
No, no. They're protesting Rouhani. They're protesting their own leadership. And this resistance movement... We've seen this before in Iran with young people. But what you just said is a bigger part of it. And that is the social media. Things being posted on social media. Things being posted on YouTube. Videos of these protests. That's something, you know, if you had a protest 30 years ago, obviously you weren't going to see that unless there was a news agency there to cover it. And that, and so that builds that resistance. If others in other parts of Iran can see the protesters in another city, and there's a number of cities where these protests are very active still today, then they can see that they're not the only ones that feel this way, and that that resistance is growing. That kind of momentum is the kind of pressure that changes regimes.
866-90-RED-EYE.
We're off on the road to Morocco.
Classic entertainers Bing Crosby and Bob Hope on the road to Morocco, a road that up until this week was blocked as far as U.S. poultry products were concerned, but Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer have just announced that the government of Morocco has agreed to allow U.S. poultry products into that nation for the first time ever. Morocco is a northwestern African nation about the size of California with almost 34 million people, and chicken is the meat most widely eaten there. Analysts say it could start out is a $10 million market for U.S. poultry with potential for growth over time. So, our poultry products can now say... In Washington, Gary Crawford, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
The USDA report is sponsored by Cenex Roadmaster XL Premium Highway Diesel Fuel and Shell Rotella.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Carley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Hey, coming up on the bottom of the hour, I do want to play one more audio cut from John Bolton when he was on, National Security Advisor John Bolton, when he was on PBS the other night. And he also talked about North Korea. Talked about Iran, talked about North Korea with Nick Schifrin of PBS. And I want to play it because it shows you that, as we said all along, forget about, you know, what the president, if he oversell the accomplishments of the concessions that they got from North Korea. As we have said, Bolton, Pompeo, they're telling the media and they're telling you what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Bolton was just, you know, straightforward and said, you know, nothing's really been, I'm not putting words in his mouth, but
at this point, nothing has changed.
Yeah, nothing's really changed. Nothing has really been accomplished, and we're still waiting. But we'll play that audio coming up here following the bottom of the hour, just because it's important.
Yeah.
Because there's one thing to be at a campaign rally, and there's one thing, okay, what's the substance of it? And Bolton's a substance kind of guy. That's what he is. And I do believe, though, and he is out an awful lot now, and I think he ought to be out an awful lot more because he's got it down. He knows how to deal with everybody in the media, and he is clear and he is concise on foreign policy, and it's something that I really believe that the majority of Americans want to hear. They want to hear that
very
clear,
direct
and concise and direct. This is what we're about.
For Omnitrax, here's your forecast.
Midweek weather highlights strong high pressure continues to build in the west. Very hot temperatures expected again today. Areas from the high plains to the northeast have the potential for severe thunderstorms and heavy rain today. And there's a major hurricane, Hector, out at sea. It's expected to pass south of Hawaii. Tropical storm force winds and other impacts may affect the Big Island. And if you're traveling, look for heavy showers today along the Oklahoma-Arkansas line. The heaviest showers forecast north of I-20, south of I-40. This will include Dallas today, high of 82 with thunderstorms. Showers on 40 up through Nashville, near 90 today, the high in Music City. Rain through a good portion of eastern Kentucky, southwest Virginia into southwest Ohio, and western West Virginia. And we'll see those showers down into the Kingsport, Bristol, Johnson City area. An active day of weather in your national forecast from Red Eye Radio. I'm meteorologist John Trout.
Thanks so much, John. 866-90-RED-EYE.
Join Gary and Eric in the Octagon now. 1-866-90-RED-EYE.
And he's Eric Hurley. I'm Gary McNamara. Good morning. Wow, this would be fun. Al Sharpton not ruling out a 2020 run for president.
Oh, please, run. Please run, Al.
Who else could we say that for? Just because... forget about the country. Mm-hmm. You know, because we're doomed. But, I mean, just for our entertainment purposes only.
Mm. Who should run?
Sharpton has to be one.
Yeah.
Grandma Gaga.
Oh, man.
Did you see the story where...
Throw your hat in the ring, Madonna, please.
You see where Madonna said, you know, her move to Portugal?
Yeah.
That was because of Trump. Because of Trump.
She moved her children to Portugal because of Trump.
And that picture with the hat on that she's wearing, I was like, well, where's Madonna?
Yeah. Didn't look like
that's,
her, did it?
That's her. She looks like a Southern... She looks like an elderly Southern belle.
Yeah.
It's like, what is this?
Who is that?
I hope after... Because she had turned 60, apparently.
Yeah, recently. She turned 60. Right. Yeah.
Is she done... I asked this question in all... Mm-hmm. In all sarcasm,
the answer is no. She's not.
Is she done taking off her clothes?
No, because Cher is still doing the show. She does a short run residency occasionally in Vegas.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. She's wearing that outfit from the video.
From the aircraft carrier.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
Al
Sharpton said in a new interview he will not rule out a run for president in 2020, adding he currently is not mounting a bid, but he'll never rule it out.
He's not ruling it in. Nobody's ruling out anything anymore, are they?
Yes, and they have him labeled as the progressive firebrand and an outspoken critic of President Donald Trump.
Progressive firebrand.
But he's an outspoken critic. Not just a critic, but an outspoken critic.
Well, how else would you be a critic? You have to speak out. Or do you just shake your head sometimes? What? Every critic is outspoken. That's the whole point. To speak out.
If Sharpton did take the plunge in 2020, he would likely join a crowded field of candidates. Among those rumored to be considering or actively considering a run include Biden, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand,
Maxine Waters.
They still have former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz.
Mm-hmm.
Former Governor Patrick of Massachusetts, and former Attorney General Eric Holder.
Maxine Waters.
Oh,
please run.
I just wish Ocasio-Cortez could run, but she can't run.
No, she can't.
That's age discrimination.
It is. It's wrong.
Will a Democrat say the Constitution has to change so Ocasio-Cortez can run?
Because that discriminates.
Discriminates against her.
Right.
Age discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I want to play this audio here from National Security Advisor John Bolton.
Okay.
Just because on the whole North Korea summit, and we had talked about this, the president's rhetoric on it, extremely positive, and we had said at that point, I'd mentioned that some of my friends were saying, well, no, the whole deal's been done. He wouldn't hold the summit unless the whole deal was done.
And
I had to tell them, guys, stop it. The whole deal is not done. It hasn't even been started yet. Oh, no, he wouldn't hold the summit. And I had talked to those same people about a week ago. They said, well, yeah, okay, you're right. It really wasn't done. I said, why are you jumping the gun on everything? I got a couple of these friends that jumped the gun on everything, and they never did it before. They're actually libertarians, and they're just jumping the gun. Oh, no, the whole deal was done. Trump wouldn't do it unless the whole deal. Guys, where are you getting this from? Are you coming up with this yourself? But, no, the deal was not done. And I said, if you listen to Bolton, if you listen to Pompeo, You know, they'll be very, very clear, as Bolton is right here in this interview with PBS. I said last night, it was actually, I've got the day wrong. It was actually Monday night.
Okay.
I keep thinking this is Tuesday. It is Wednesday. Mm. It's always great when you're a day behind. I always like that. I always like when, you know, I think it's Thursday and it's a Friday.
It's actually Friday.
Friday, yeah. That's always
fun. It doesn't work in the opposite way. That's not a good feeling.
But here's Bolton being asked a question on North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Just want to ask, in the brief time I have left, a couple questions on North Korea. North Korea has frozen nuclear tests, as you know. They've blown up the entrance to their nuclear test facility. They've shut down an engine testing site. They've handed over remains of U.S. soldiers. And North Korea now says that the U.S. is backtracking from some of the commitments that the president made in Singapore. So what steps has the U.S. taken to live up to the president's commitments in Singapore to provide security guarantees and to establish a new relationship with North Korea?
Well, the president at Singapore suspended major joint exercises between the United States and South Korea. That's been done. But what was significant about Singapore was the North Korean commitment to denuclearize, and they have not taken effective steps to do that. Let's just take the decision to close the entrances, as you correctly say, to the Punggye-ri nuclear test site. That was done before the agreement. There were no international observers present, really, to inspect what was done. There were some, you'll forgive me, representatives of the media who were kept at a distance and not shown anything except the bright explosion. And I think the view in South Korea and elsewhere is that that test site is not necessarily disabled. That's why when you engage in the process of denuclearization, you need international inspection. You need declarations of what North Korea has. You need observers and inspectors who can verify exactly what's happening. That needs to take place in a process of negotiation. We've asked again recently for Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to return to Pyongyang to meet again with Kim Jong-un on this subject. We're not looking for rhetoric here. We're looking for performance of North Korea's own commitment made to us, made to South Korea beforehand, to denuclearize.
Yep.
It's
pretty
simple. And what he's saying is what we said all along. There is no evidence that they are denuclearizing. And as that's the first that we found out about the one nuclear test site that the claim was made, and Nick Schifrin from PBS was stating it as fact, and what
right.
Bolton was saying was, well, it's not really fact unless you've got inspectors on the ground. Reporters held at a distance aren't inspectors. You need to find out what they have. You need to do an inventory, and then you need to have inspectors on the ground with unfettered access, as we have said all along.
Yes, and this administration doesn't have unfettered access to California. So
yes.
The hopes that they would get unfettered access to North Korea, because you have ask yourself, all right, UN inspectors, right? How is it, or who is it that would expect a Kim Jong-un to open up his doors and in an unprecedented manner give unfettered access essentially to the world, because it likely would be a UN inspection team? That's not going to happen. It, because what happens ultimately, if you think this through, if his greatest of weapons are gone, then his power is gone. And it's not long before he's done. This is a man who has reached outside of his own borders to kill his half-brother because his half-brother was a threat to his power. He's not about to give up his nukes. It's not going to happen.
And so, again, when you look at it, if you want to know what's going on inside the administration, you know, and especially when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to Iran, when it comes to Russia, when it comes to North Korea, Bolton probably is the best person to go to.
Yes. I would keep everyone in their respective roles ready for the media.
And I
want to address those.
And I want to make this clear. Bolton has, you know, he was saying this at the same time that the president was, you know, doing the public relations of the North Korea summit.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, you know, these things necessarily haven't fully happened. Listen to Bolton.
Right.
What is his own administration saying on it? And so the point is, the administration is not fooled by anything. People that have said, well, North Korea is fooling this administration, you and I have never bought into that idea.
No, 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 not the case. Not the case. Even in his standalone press conference there in Singapore, the president telling the media, and it was, you know, in the States, it was the middle of the night. And as our boss tells us, nothing good happens in the middle of the night and no one pays attention to it if it does. The president was telling the media, look, in a year from now, we might look back and say, well, this wasn't a great deal and it didn't work out. And you know me, I'll probably make up an excuse for it. He was joking with the media, a little self-deprecating humor that is fairly rare. But it is, you can see it and you can hear it very clearly from Bolton, from Pompeo. There's really nothing to be, we're light years from being able to say that any change has been made on the part of North Korea.
But the goal should not be the expectation that Kim Jong-un has finally seen the light and will get rid of all of his nuclear weapons, and that's a distinct possibility in the next couple of years.
Yeah, right.
I don't see that happening. What I see from this administration, and I guess if you talk to Bolton and you ask him the question and got into a pretty intensive conversation, he would agree with it, which would be, look, we can't dictate what they do. All we can do is, you know, get them to agree to do certain things to denuclearize, as they have. If they don't do it, we don't act like previous administrations. By the way, as the president has said, and we don't continue on this hopeful theme that, okay, maybe if we just do a little bit more, maybe if we reduce the sanctions a year from now, well, then they'll come back to the table again. No, it's done.
Right.
Our policy changes with you.
I think that was the plan all along. I think that's when you have this situation, which is really ushered in and orchestrated clearly by Mike Pompeo, I think the goal was to demonstrate to the world that you really made an effort here. And you demonstrate clearly in front of the world that you did make that effort, that you gave Kim Jong-un the chance. Not that they expected things to change, but you basically put the ball squarely in his court so that if a preemptive strike is needed and an attack by North Korea, whether it's on South Korea or one of our enemies or Americans or one of our allies or even on American soil, if what an attack by him is imminent and you have to strike preemptively, I think you've done your work, you've crossed your T's, and it streamlines that process.
And I see the same thing going on with Iran right now.
Yes.
I'll meet with the president.
I'll sit down with Rouhani.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'll sit down with him, but here are the sanctions. And here's what wasn't covered in the Iran deal, which was why it was a bad deal. And any negotiations must include this. This, as Bolton was pointing out, ballistic missiles, terrorism, the whole ball of wax. Mm-hmm. It just isn't about one thing. It is about becoming part of the, in essence, do you wish to become part of the Western world?
Right.
because your people certainly do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, with the protests going on yesterday, as we said, directed not at Trump.
Yep.
But at their own government.
Right. And while there's no or very little hope for North Korea to turn around, there could be at least some shifting by Iran and Venezuela. With Maduro saying last week, yeah, socialism's not really working. Well, you want to change the, if you want to change your economy and your situation and deal with the world, you're going to have to, like the Saudis have learned, you're going to have to open up. You're going to have to change the way you play the game.
Maybe the Republicans could hire him to come up and talk to Ocasio-Cortez.
That's funny because here, more young people jumping on socialism because they don't know what it's about. And he's saying, yeah, it's really not working. Turn away. Turn away.
866-90-RED-EYE.
The Detroit powertrain offers efficiency through innovation. Detroit's Brad Williamson has all the details.
A lot of the people in the industry have been doing downspeeding for a while. This is really our first entry into that arena, if you will. So we've combined a DD15 mm-hmm. with a DT12 automated transmission and a 6x2 axle. And you can also get a 6x4, but really it's a complete powertrain. All three pieces, including the front axle, obviously all four pieces are from Detroit. And it also has something in the transmission called intelligent powertrain management. It's a better step towards predictive technology. So it looks a mile in front of you when you're driving. It knows the territory and the terrain you're going to come up on, and it manages the engine and the transmission the most optimally as that it can when you're in cruise control.
For more on the Detroit powertrain, log on to demanddetroit.com. For Shell Rotella, that's the engine report.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. He's Eric Carney, and I'm Gary McNamara. Well, there you have it. For the first time ever, as the preseason games get ready to kick off this Thursday, the first male cheerleaders in the NFL.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it because I'm no longer watching the NFL.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One.